Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Richard, we just finished a great interview with, Ohio State Buckeye.
A colleague.
Yeah.
From Ohio State.
Yeah. Kip Pietrantonio.
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 Yeah, it's P-I-E-T. Pietrantonio.
Yeah.
He's a counseling psychologist.
Richard, what they are doing at Ohio State University is
pretty impressive.
It's impressive. This interview was all about Kip's work at Ohio State, some of the work that their counseling center is doing, mm-hmm. what parents and students can expect when they go off to college. Right. But man, what they're doing!
Yeah, if you're a listener and you're not familiar with what colleges offer these days, mm-hmm. Most colleges and universities have a counseling center.
Right.
So when students encounter difficulties, they have a place to go.
Right.
Ohio State, the largest campus,
largest single
self-contained
campus
in the country, right. 63,000.
Well, he said at that particular campus, it was about 57,000 students
right.
at that one campus.
Right. And we have most university, Georgia, USA, about 37,000. Even
right.
Florida has, I think, 37,000, maybe
yeah.
40. So to have 57,000 students
at one campus
is really, really impressive. And they have 40-some counselors
right.
in a four-story building.
Right.
Okay. Now, 40-some counselors can't meet the needs of 57,000 students.
Right.
So what they've had to do, they've done some pretty creative things about mm-hmm. getting outreach. And one of the things I like is they have, he said daily
yeah.
workshops.
Yeah.
So they present
daily
workshops every day.
Right.
Okay.
Fantastic.
And they're not presented as, that would be much less threatening
mm-hmm.
to college students to go to a lecture about anxiety
right.
rather than go to a if you're not ready to go to a therapist
right.
about your anxiety,
right.
you can go to this. So they're looking at ways to expand their services without having to hire more counselors.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great. And Kip is doing a lot of great work. I mean, he talked about he's worked in Michigan. He's worked in the Dakota, North Dakota. He's worked in California.
Santa Cruz.
And so he's been all over the place. In his bio, he talks about he's been featured in the Wall Street Journal,
yeah.
the Chronicles
mm-hmm.
of Higher Education, and even on NPR.
NPR,
he's
right.
been all over the place. And this guy, it was a great conversation.
Very comfortable
yeah.
in the camera,
yeah.
very, very at ease.
Yeah, you know, and you can tell he is really passionate about the
passionate
work that
about
he's doing.
Work. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he co-hosts. They have their own podcast.
They do.
There. He and a doctoral student.
Midwestern Social Scientists
right.
podcast.
And he calls it Podomatics.
Well, Podomatic is the service that they do their podcast through.
Right.
But yeah, the Midwestern Social Scientists, definitely check out their podcast. They talk about cool things. Like they did one on about an episode of South Park. They did
really
the most recent one that he was just mm-hmm. telling us about. Is about Snapchat. So we're gonna have to get
Snapchat.
On
I have to get that. I'm gonna watch that with my daughter and one
yeah.
of my coworkers.
Yeah. Me?
No.
Miss
Cassie.
Miss Cassie
taught me how to use Snapchat. So unlike some who didn't teach me how to do Twitter.
No.
But no, Miss Cassie taught me how to do Snapchat. So
yeah.
I'm gonna go on and listen to that one and have my daughter listen to it too.
Yeah. yeah. So this podcast is going to be all about mental health in colleges.
Right.
And we're gonna end with some great recommendations from Kip about how
mm-hmm.
high school seniors and
right.
parents of high school students can get ready for that transition to college and
right.
lead find more success when they get off there.
Yeah, he had good advice at the end.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
yeah.
So take a listen.
Absolutely. So check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to podcast. We'd love to hear from you what you think. Definitely follow Kip and listen to his podcast
mm-hmm.
and follow him on Twitter. All those links are in the show notes for you to check out. So
right.
All right. So enjoy the interview. So you doing all right on this Saturday morning?
I'm doing wonderful. It's just about to start heating up here in Ohio. You guys are down in Florida, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's been heated up here since
April.
January.
Oh, geez. Well, I have nothing to complain about then, do I?
No, it's been, man, the last couple of weeks especially have just been brutal here. It's been really hot.
And we started our rainy season this week. Yeah. So it rains every day now for the next few months.
And then it gets humid. And then you have to swim to the car.
So you're in Columbus. Yeah.
I am. And I remember when I went down to APA for Orlando,
right,
when it was in Orlando, and had to wear a suit. And I was like, I don't understand how people do this.
No. It's not fun. It's not fun. I remember I went to what was it? Rhode Island.
Right.
It was in March or April or something like that. And they said that the hotels don't even turn the air conditioners on until May or June or something like that. And I was like, how do you do that? That's foreign. We had the air conditioner on for Christmas.
So. Right. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So you guys are actually in practice together?
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, wow. That's really cool. That's incredible. And that's great. You guys can do the podcast too. And wow, what a cool thing.
Yeah. Yeah. This little studio is right next to our offices where we see patients. So it's, keep everything contained.
Definitely.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Where are you now? Are you at home or are you in the,
Nope. I came down to the office. I can't trust my dog. Yeah, this is my office that I actually work out of. This is where I see clients. I can't trust my dog at home. Like, he's going to bark. I guarantee he'll be quiet until I start recording, right? And then as soon as we start recording, he'll start running around or chasing something. So,
dogs and kids, you know,
can completely relate with that.
So that's a nice office.
Yeah.
I actually get to run group out of my office. Which
Dude,
is
that
really
big?
Nice. We have a lot of space. So
that's nice.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we're very lucky here at Ohio State. They give us a really, really nice space to work out of, which not every counseling center, of course, can say, sadly. So,
yep.
That's great.
Well, before we begin, I'll promise not to talk about Urban Meyer.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Well, yeah, he's actually a pretty interesting character when it comes to mental health. He released kind of this big article this year about mental health, and it was kind of interesting because on one hand he was like being a very big advocate for taking care of yourself, and then on the other hand he was still kind of like, well, you just got to tough through it.
That's what I would have predicted. Right.
Yeah, so it was a little bit of both, and so it was kind of interesting. So a lot of my clients or a lot of my students were talking about the article when it came out. So
okay.
Yeah, and I think that Richard Warhays, University of Florida, tied today just for that reason.
Del Urban.
Awesome. Okay. Well, can I tell you the secret? The real secret, though, is that I'm from Michigan, and I used to work at.
That's even worse.
And I used to work at the University of Michigan right before I worked at Ohio State. So.
Okay, I'll take it all back then. All right, you have a bigger problem than I do.
I know. I get no love from either side. So.
No. Nope.
Well, but it is a pleasure to talk to you. I know that we've been emailing for a while about getting together and talking and sort of doing this podcast. And there were so many topics that we could talk about because your work and your research is very interesting, and it's quite varied, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, my dissertation, all my schoolwork, everything kind of like that I focused on in graduate school was all on social class. And then that inevitably led to me being on the APA committee and then becoming the vice chair of the Committee on Social Economic Status. But I've always kind of stayed grounded in my college mental health work because I just love working with the students. And so it's, you know, sometimes it intersects where I'll get to work with students from low income backgrounds, or, you know, coming out of Cleveland, coming out of Dayton, coming out of Cincinnati, some of these Rust Belt cities. And that's a real privilege, you know, because I'm a first generation college student. So that's kind of where my heart lies. But definitely my clinical work is very wide ranging, as you both, I'm sure, are generalists. I'm kind of a generalist. So I see whatever comes in the door. So.
Yeah. Right.
That's where we are too.
Yeah.
Don't have the luxury of specializing.
Right.
Nor do we want to. We like the variety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what got you into the area of researching and thinking about, you know, college students specifically? Was it that you were a first-time, first-generation college student?
Yeah, I think so. And I just view college itself as being such a gateway to economic liberty, economic freedom, success, like, opening your mind, kind of enlightenment. And so helping as many people get through that process as possible, that's kind of what I view as my job, is to ultimately help people get through the college process so they can have access to all the wonderful things that come with a college degree. I really get upset when I hear people talk about, like, oh, college degrees are so useless. Or like, no, nowadays, like, a college degree doesn't mean anything. Still, to this day, only about 37% of the population has a bachelor's degree. And so people don't realize that you're still in a very exclusive class. About 8% has a master's degree and about 1% has a PhD. And so, if you can break into that top, 70, whatever, 74%, it really makes a difference for their quality of life. And so helping students get through that is really important. And when you do it at a, school with 63,000 students, it presents a lot of unique challenges. So
I can imagine. I can imagine.
Now, can we talk about social class for a minute?
Sure.
So how did that interest arise?
Sure. So my background, I kind of come, like, there's a lot of people who say, like, research is me search. And so my background is I grew up in Michigan, and if you know anything about Michigan, it's an economically devastated place. One of our former governors actually said that when the country gets the flu, Michigan gets pneumonia. And so my dad worked for a grocery store called Red Owl for 22 years, earned a pension, and when he actually went to collect his pension, they said there is no pension. And so he actually had to go and started his own business, and he went and became a wallpaper painter for a little while, and then he got sick. He got an autoimmune disease where his white blood cells started to attack his lung tissue, and he actually became disabled. And so I kind of have the, economic part from the work economic kind of from a working standpoint, like my dad losing his pension, but then also diving into, like, the healthcare world, which are two of the major reasons that people fall into poverty. Right. It's healthcare and, like, something not working, being laid off or, not getting their pension. And so that was really important to me growing up, was learning to understand that and learning to understand how it affected me personally, how it affected my understanding of the world, how it affected, my own understanding of trusting institutions. And so that's what kind of got me interested in that social class perspective. And I also view, like, money and economics as often being kind of a core fundamental driver of, like, capitalism and society and some of the inequalities. So as a psycho, I'm a counseling psychologist, so we're very committed to social justice and diversity. And I think a lot of the key inequality issues, whether it be racism, gender, sexism, the pay gap, a lot of them are all driven by economic inequality. Right. And so I kind of view social class as one of, like, these core areas of, if you're going to study social justice, you have to go there. And unfortunately, I think social class doesn't get the same respect that, gender studies or racism, or it kind of gets, it's always the last chapter of the multicultural book. If you list something, if you list off, like, types of diversity, it's like, it's always the last one that nobody remembers. And unfortunately, when they did a study, APA every year does this study called the Stress in America research, and they want to figure out what is the most stressful thing of the year. And last year, actually 2 years ago now, money is almost always in the top three for the things that are stressing people out the most. Yet we spend very little time researching how money and economics, lack of money, lack of resourcing, lack of housing, however you want to look at it, actually affects people.
Wow, so your life experiences have really sort of guided you to some of these areas that you work with, not only work clinically, but also with some of your research and these interests.
Yeah, definitely. And so, you always got to be watching out for countertransference, and you don't want to be, like, you don't want to be putting that your experience onto other people. But, as long as you're being mindful and thoughtful about all that stuff, I think it can be really rewarding to work on things you've experienced yourself. I know in your guys' podcast, you often talk about your own kids, and you're like, and you tie it to the research, and I think that really brings it home and makes it more personal when you're like, oh, and my, kid isn't patient, and I have to be like, 5 more minutes, so I can talk to you. it really brings it home, and I think people can connect to it a little bit more. So I know with my low-income students especially, I'll talk a little bit about my background just to kind of show that, hey, like, I know where you're coming from. I went through something similar. It's not the same experience that you have, but, you know, maybe we can connect on that. So,
yeah, absolutely. That connection is so important.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, heck with counter-transference, you know. Let them know you know. Otherwise, they're going to think, well, what, you don't understand because everything was paid for and, you know, you were born with a golden spoon, you know, silver spoon in your mouth. If they know you haven't been or that you're not, it gives you the credibility that they'll listen to you.
So. Yeah, definitely. And, credibility and that, you know, that I can see their experience and recognize that they may have had things that I didn't experience just because my race or my gender or something afforded me some type of privilege maybe they didn't get. So
yeah, that's one of the differences here. We have a large number of brown and black who are in poverty, brown children, black children. Poverty is the problem, but they have unique experiences. The poor, my family is from Ohio, and they, so I grew up in the Rust Belt. And watched my uncles go through the steel mills and the closing of the steel mills and watched their children struggle because while my uncles were able to make a good living, my cousins weren't. They weren't able to reach that same level. But here it's different because the Mexican and Central American children in Florida have very, very different experiences than we did. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to empathize because their experiences have been so different, especially the first generation. Immigrant children.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that, and just, you know, they may still be living in poverty, but have come from such a worse place.
Right.
Exactly. And now it feels like a luxury, but for you guys, you're still looking at a different perspective. I know, especially those children who maybe are coming out of, or the children that are coming out of like those refugee camps.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I know it can be a really, really big challenge. I know we have some of those folks up here in Ohio too, who are coming, you know, they kind of came across the border and it's like, here you are. They don't speak any English or anything. It's really hard. We just kind of expect them to cope, you know.
Right.
Which can,
right.
And as much as you'd like to say, I understand how you feel, we can't, you know.
Yeah. Right.
Their experiences have been unique. Yeah. So so your area of research is social class.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. What courses do you teach?
I don't teach any courses, actually. I just do. No, I don't. I actually teach a little, like, we do like workshops every day of the week. So I actually teach a workshop on anxiety every single week. So I'll have like anywhere from 20 to 90 students come in and do like an hour, kind of listen to me talk about anxiety. But, and every week that's a little different based on what the students bring into the room. But other than that, I don't actually teach anything directly. So,
okay.
Oh, great. Great.
Where do you do those, like, where do you do those workshops? In the counseling center?
In our building, we're in a 4-story building, so the counseling center is up on the 4th floor. We actually have a couple of classrooms that we have access to down on the 1st floor. And so Ohio State has this incredibly well, and I'm not just sucking up to Ohio State, I really think this is incredible, is they have this really great system set up where every first-year student has to go to a certain amount of, like, kind of out-of-the-classroom activities. And so almost every single freshman student ends up coming to one of our mental health workshops.
Wow, that's great.
So it's really great because, you know, obviously we can't see everybody in one-on-one counseling.
Mm-hmm,
you know, right. So at the big challenge in college counseling now is how do we meet the needs of everybody outside of the one-on-one relationship?
Right,
so,
right.
You know, at our center, we're running 35 groups. We offer workshops every day. You know what I mean? We're going out and we touched 1/3 of the campus with our outreach events.
Wow.
You know, so we're really trying to get creative because you just simply can't treat every single case of anxiety on the campus, and you can't just keep hiring therapists forever. It's impossible. So you have to start getting creative in the way that you're reaching folks. And truthfully, not everybody needs one-on-one counseling.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah. Well, I have a number of questions that relate to that, because you're never going to have enough counselors to do one-on-one. I mean, nobody will. Okay. When you have 63,000 students, is that on the Columbus campus?
That's between, we have two main camp. The main campus is Columbus, and Columbus itself is actually the biggest single college campus in the country.
Is it?
And so like Arizona State, they're split up a little bit more. Florida's split up a little bit more. But we, as far as having a central campus, we have about 58,000 students on this campus.
Right.
And then we have a couple of other satellite campuses that make up about the other 3,000-4,000.
So, wow. But you have 57,000 right there.
We do.
On your campus. How many counselors do you have?
We have about like 40 to 60, depending on how many trainees we have in any given year.
Okay.
And so we have trainees from social work, counseling, psychology interns, doctoral interns. We have clinical fellows. We have psychiatry residents. And so depending on how many of those we get, it will be up to closer to 50, 60. But still, you know, that's never going to be enough. And we are actually one of the biggest counseling centers in the country, if not the biggest counseling center in the country. And so we're kind of ahead of the game in terms of like how many staff we actually have.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. Yeah, we work at the University of South Florida. Well, you're there much more often than I am. But wow, I mean, I think that is
economies of scale.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I don't know how much bigger that, I don't know what the current
30-some thousand.
Is it 30-something thousand? But I don't even think that they have half that number of counselors there.
I'll have to check and see. The University of Central Florida has become the largest university in the state.
In Florida.
Yeah. I was at the University of Texas in the 90s, and we had about 54,000 students on a single campus. But I think University of Central Florida is our biggest, and I have no idea how many counselors they have at
yeah.
the counseling center.
Yeah. That's an incredible number of counselors. Wow.
Right. Are you an APA site?
Yes. We have five psych interns here, and we are accredited, and we have a separate accreditation called IACS as well, which they simply accredit counseling centers.
Wow.
So.
Okay. All right. So how long have you been there?
I'm going into my fourth year, but I've actually worked in college counseling for about the last 6 years. So before working at Ohio State, I worked at the University of Michigan's Counseling Center for postdoc. I did my resident or my our doctoral internship out at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And then I worked at the University of North Dakota's Counseling Center, which is where I did my graduate school. So I've been in college counseling for pretty much my entire clinical, you know, career here. So.
Right. Have you seen much change over the past maybe decade or so, or six to 10 years that you've been working in college campuses?
Definitely. So there's a few different things that have, I'm getting an echo.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay.
I can hear myself though.
Oh, okay.
I think it just went away.
Okay.
Yeah, what I was talking about that. So anyway, the editing, yay. So there's been a lot of changes. So one of the big ones is the primary diagnosis that people were coming in for when I started was depression. And that has now switched nationwide to anxiety.
Right.
So that's one of the big shifts in terms of like what we're seeing is that students are coming in very, very anxious. Part of that, I think, is the SAT score for Ohio State this year was 29. That was the average.
Wow. SAT or ACT?
Oh, excuse me, ACT. I misspoke. Yeah, ACT was a 29 this year. And
wow.
So that's, you know, and we're a state school. You
right.
know what I mean? So when you're at like a University of Michigan or a Stanford or, you know, somewhere else that's a little bit more, you know, Ivy League, you know, we're talking perfect score is average. And
right.
So what's happening is these students are coming in and there's so much competition. How I like to describe it is it's like ducks swimming on a pond, right? And on the surface, everybody's looking at every other duck going, wow, this is amazing. Everybody's just going along perfectly smoothly. And then there's people like us in the counseling center and we get to look under the water and see that everybody's paddling rapidly to keep the illusion alive.
Right.
And so what happens is there's mill of like social comparison, and then you add social media in there, and you hear about everybody getting an internship, and there's 30,000 people going to a career fair.
Wow.
And so what happens is it just creates this sense of anxiety in these students, and then you compile it with, you know, back in the old days when you'd fail physics, it wasn't really a big deal. You just take it again next semester, right? Now, if you have to stay for another year at Ohio State or some other big school, it might cost you $20,000-$30,000 extra.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, you know, getting not getting a good grade in a class becomes a huge deal in terms of, and there's so much competition to get into your major, and there's so much competition to get those internships, and people are so afraid that they're not going to be able to get a job afterwards.
Right.
And so that's one of the big shifts. The other shift we're seeing, which is really interesting, is an increase in more severe pathology. And that has come with the advent of like more advanced psychotropics.
Right.
And so as we're seeing more and more cases of schizophrenia, we're seeing more cases of people going psychotic. You know, they'll try marijuana for the first time and, you know, all of a sudden
right.
coming back and having all these psychotic symptoms. And that's something because I think traditionally those, you know, neuroatypical students weren't making it
right.
to college versus now they are. And, you know, when they get here, they take up a lot of space in mental health world,
right.
you know, because they come in and there's kind of an expectation that if I'm paying, you know, if the parents are paying $80,000 for this degree, they want everything taken care of. They better have a place to live. They better have mental health treatment. Oh, you have a counseling center? Oh, you have psychiatrists at the counseling center? Why can't they be seen there for all 4 years?
Right.
And that's great. We would love to see them all for 4 years, but it's just not logistically possible.
Right. So. Right. Well, you know, that shift to more of an anxiety population, you know, struggling with anxiety makes sense. We've talked a lot before about the education system in general and how, you know, through parenting and through educational experiences, the expectation is perfection. Mm-hmm. You know, you have students graduating high school with like 4.6 GPAs on a 4.0 scale. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and then they get to college and they're just expecting eight straight A's, you know, they're expecting to be able to just cruise right along like they always have. And mm-hmm. it just isn't the same.
Yeah, it's definitely not possible. And, you know, something you guys talked about in your technology podcast that I wanted to ask you about is you guys talked about this, like, inability to tolerate boredom.
Right, right.
Right, in kids. And I wonder, I want to ask you guys this question. When that happens, when we get to college and you combine that with a hyper high level of ambition, mm-hmm. what do you think happens to these students? Because what I see is that they take a full load of classes and then they have to go to and be in like six different clubs and organizations and mm-hmm. they have to, you know, they have to do everything. And then they're like, oh, and I can't sleep at night and I don't know why.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So I'm curious what you guys see, because you guys have more of a developmental perspective than I think I do. What do you mm-hmm. think happens with that, where that boredom thing can kind of get ugly or get kind of get odd, you know? So I'm mm-hmm. curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that the issue that I tend to see is that they get overloaded because they have to fill every minute of their day. And you know, those are the freshman students that you probably tend to see that come in their first semester. You know, they're the ones that sign up for those 7:30 a.m. classes. Right. And it's like, what are you doing 7:30 a.m.?
Right.
You know, you've just been complaining for 5 years about having to get up early to go to high school. And here you are doing that in college. And they, you know, they petition for those overloads so they can take more than 12 to 15 hours. And then they think that they can still have a social life and they can still do all those other things. So yeah, I think that they get overwhelmed and they'll tend to get burned out. And, you know, many times those are the students who, they are at risk for crashing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it doesn't tend to bode well. And for a lot of those students in when they go off to college like that, you know, they don't have the parents there still to kind of rescue them a little bit. They kind of get lost.
Right.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
I think what we're seeing, we have the same phenomenon here in Florida at the University of Florida. It's the flagship university here. And the SAT, ACT and grade point averages keep rising every year. So it has become, my daughter just graduated from the University of Florida this spring, and she said that everybody's smart and they're all competing.
Right.
I think at the University of South Florida, there were 6,000 applicants for 120 positions in the medical
school. Oh my gosh.
In the medical school. We had 120 openings and there were 6,200 applicants.
Yeah.
And so and these kids are facing that kind of pressure.
Right.
And like you said, Kip, these are at state schools. And
right.
it makes me think that, you remember that book, David and Goliath?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I remember it perfectly, but I remember it.
But he talks about that girl who went to Brown. And she got a B in a class, and she absolutely fell apart.
Right.
Okay. Because the pressure is so intense that a single B caused her to drop out of the program and leave the university.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if this, because of what's happening at the state schools, if we're not creating the same culture, the same climate at our state universities, especially the flagship universities. Well, Michigan's always been that, but Ohio State certainly is becoming that. Florida has become that. Florida is becoming that.
Yeah.
The University of Texas certainly was.
Yeah.
And we're creating sort of this Ivy League culture of high pressure.
In state schools.
In state schools.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And yeah, I think that's like that 120 spots thing. I mean, that right there is stuff I hear every single day.
Yeah.
And you try to do like good CBT work where you talk about catastrophizing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm sitting here and I'm like, is this catastrophizing?
Right.
Or is this just the state of the world, right? And
yeah.
so you end up in this kind of tricky wicket because you don't want to tell the student they're being irrational because,
right.
you know, I know we never say that to a student, like a client directly, but you don't want to kind of imply it because there's a truth to that, right? That
right.
there really is only 120 spots. And so if you don't have like a perfect application with a perfect background, with a perfect GPA, with a, you know, you're probably not going to get into those spots.
Yeah,
right.
a B or two could get you kicked out of the first round of applications.
Yeah.
You know, we'll take all the students who have perfect GRE scores or perfect MCAT scores and perfect grades, and we'll begin our selection process with them.
Yeah.
And so it is their reality. I mean, this is what these kids are facing. I think there's another issue, though, with I'm interested in this anxiety issue because the other thing that my 20 something patients are telling me is that they were lied to.
Mm-hmm.
That they were told,
right,
all you have to do is get good grades, get your degree, and the world will open up to you.
Right.
And when
right.
they finish their degree, the world doesn't open up for them any more than it did for us. But they tell me, you lied to us about what was going to happen.
I think that's an interesting perspective. I'd be curious what they mean by when they say lie. What I notice happens to a lot of students, and I think a lot of it happens kind of developmentally too, is that students up to this point, everything has been lock and key.
Right?
Right. First grade goes to second grade goes to third grade, high school. Okay, here's the best school. This is the one you want to aim for. If you can't go to that one, here's the other one. And then all of a sudden, you're in senior year. You're getting your degree, and it's like, go get a job.
Right.
And you wouldn't believe how many seniors that I work with that are like, how do I do that?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm like, okay, have you started looking? And they're like, well, what do you mean? Just like go to Monster or go to Indeed?
Yeah.
And they have no concept of networking. They have no concept of, I should talk to my professors to see if they have any ideas, because there hasn't been a class that has shown them this is how you then do the next thing.
Right.
And so you wouldn't believe how often, I would say at least at any given time, I am helping a student with their resume, which is totally outside of my worldview.
Right.
But it's a critical thing in my work at this point to be able, because they have to have something to put on Indeed or LinkedIn or whatever. And that's the first step. So sometimes I feel like I'm just kind of pushing them out of the nest myself.
Mm-hmm.
Going, all right, you got to go because you got to start doing this. And so when you open up the whole world, I end up as a therapist giving them structure.
Right.
I will say to them, okay, where do you want to live?
Right.
Do you want to stay in Columbus, or would you like to go back to like Cleveland, or would you want to go to like Denver or LA or where? And then we go from there to what type of job? Okay, let's get on Indeed. Let's get on Monster. Let's get on whatever and start looking at those jobs. So I end up having to create a structure for them in order for them to go to that next developmental stage.
Right. I think that's what they meant by the lie, because these are the children who have been shown every step of the way what they have to do.
Everything's been programmed since pre-K.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So they go to high school, you take these courses, you get these grades. Then you go to college. One of my pet peeves are rubrics. You have to do rubrics, okay? Because here, these are the courses you take. I mean, even when a kid goes to college, here are the courses. This is the order in which you take them. You apply for the program in your sophomore year, and then this is how you do this course, and you follow these rubrics for this assignment. We have, at the University of South Florida, we have to have a rubric for every assignment that we make. And so we have to tell a student, if you want to get an A, this is what you do. If you want to get a B, this is what you do. And I have to build those into my syllabi every semester. I have to build a rubric for every assignment. So these kids can just walk almost, it's like the Walking Dead. They can walk through, they just go, get up every morning, go to your classes, do what's on the syllabus, and then you leave.
Mm-hmm.
They have been told, you called it lock and key. They've been led each step of the way. Then they get to this next step, which is getting a job. They have absolutely no idea how to do that.
Right.
None. Yep. And I think that's what, and what they're saying to me is, well, no, you told me if I did all these things at the end, these wonderful things would happen to me, that I could be the CEO of a company, that I could be on the board of directors. Right. They have no concept of what it's like once they leave the university setting.
Right. That's it right on the head. I think part of it though is that, as you know, as I was thinking more about what you were saying, I think there is a little bit of a sense of being lied to generationally. And just, I will speak as a, I am technically a millennial, so I will speak as a millennial for a second.
You were a millennial?
I am technically a millennial based on the definition I know of millennial. So,
okay.
I think there is a sense of, I was told if I did these things, I would work hard. That would lead to happiness and success and agency and freedom within my job.
Right.
And I think what's happening is a lot of these students are ending up having to get a job at Starbucks or something where it's totally like, why did I go to college? Or, you know, unless they are an engineer,
exactly.
Unless they are in one of these hard sciences where they go get that next job.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this sense of like, I did everything right. And I think where I especially see it is like, as I talk to, and this is outside of like actual clinical work, but when I talk to people who are 4 or 5 years outside of their college degree, and they've, let's say they became a teacher, you know, and 5 years in, they're just so unhappy because they're like, I'm getting paid $35,000. I'm working 70 hours a week at this school. And what did I thought this was supposed to allot me a better life.
Have the life that their parents had.
Right, the life that their parents have. And so I think that there's a kind of a generational anger that's kind of building up within this group, and it kind of, they want to lash out. But I agree, it's paired with a lack of structure, a lack of, like, you have to go after it a little bit.
Right. Well, like you said, let's start on a live. You know, so many of these, well, I don't want to go to South Dakota. Well, I don't want to go to Wyoming. I don't want to go to Texas.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry. That's the way it works. You go and you make it work from there. And they're not thinking of it that way. You know, I want to stay in Berkeley. You know, the most highly educated wait staff in the world is in Berkeley, California. They all, you know, every waiter in Berkeley has a PhD. And because they don't want to leave Berkeley. Okay. Well, that's fine. But you have to be willing to make those changes. And these kids just aren't prepared to do it. They're not told, you go get a college degree and then the work begins.
Right.
They're thinking that's the end of the journey.
Right.
And it's not. Mm-hmm. And that's what they feel, that they've been deceived a little.
Well, yeah, I think it oftentimes it leads to, you know, they're just not fully informed. I was talking to a college student who's majoring in psychology, and she was coming to me to ask about, you know, what's next. And so I'm talking to her about, you know, sort of some of the processes for going to graduate school and everything. And she said, she goes to a university that I don't work at. And she said, nobody's told me this. I'm a senior and I have no research experience. I haven't written anything because nobody's told me that I need to do this. And so she's going to end up with her bachelor's degree in psychology, but not be able to do anything with it because she doesn't know because she hasn't been informed. And I think that's the other concern about lying to them, that, you know, nobody's told me all this information. It's just, if you do it, these things will happen for you. And they don't understand that there's some other pieces that have to go along with it.
Right.
So let me ask you guys a question. What your thought process on this, do you think that the solution to that is that we create a class where it teaches them how to apply to a job? Or is the solution that throughout college, we give them reminders like the structure is ending, the structure is ending, the structure is ending. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious because like I can tell you it feels like the way the world is going, we would create a class.
Right.
Where
they
then do that and we would go, here's your resume, here's how you get it online, here. And we would just continue the structure until they get to the work setting. And then when they get to the work setting, they can have a nice onboarding process, you know.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm curious what you guys think. Would that be the way to go? Or is it kind of more we got to get people more used to a lack of structure kind of throughout the process?
I think that you're absolutely right. I think it will become a class. Ideally, it will start with I'm going to throw the big wrench. It will start with, we're going to stop giving away participation trophies. That's where it will start. That's where it should start. It should start from the very beginning where you say, you know, if you want something, you know, you have to go out for it. You have to look for what you're interested in. You have to, you know, you have to put forth effort and you know, energy and drive and passion into it. You know, students aren't encouraged to find passions anymore. It's just, you know, again, this lock and key. You just do these things and everything is going to open up for you. And, you know, from elementary school, but especially in high school, that's never really the experience they have. Mm-hmm. They just don't have that experience in life. And I think it does have to start during those more developmental periods of life because, you know, learning that at 22 is going to be really difficult, mm-hmm. unless it's in a class or something. You've just had 22 years of life where that hasn't been true. And so now all of a sudden this professor is going to tell me that, why would I believe that, you know?
Right.
Kim, I have a couple of related questions. When you say the biggest mental health issue that you're dealing with today is anxiety, mm-hmm. Are most students anxious? Is that your sense that they're pretty much all the ducks are pedaling fast?
Well, I would say we see a lot of different types of students. I think that the anxiety is on the rise. I wouldn't say every student is anxious. We also have students who are really depressed. They don't go to class. They're kind of burned out. We also have students who came to college to party.
Right.
And then class, it matters, but it's a distant second. You know, I think the high achieving students, the ones who are attending, we're seeing in the junior, senior, who make it to that junior, senior year are definitely much more anxious. But, you know, I mean, anxiety manifests, as you guys both know as clinicians, right? Anxiety manifests in a lot of ways,
right?
So it might be around career. It might be I can't sleep. It might be about body image, mm-hmm. right? And it's the social comparison, for example, to other women in your sorority. You know, mm-hmm. and it's feeling not good enough, so it comes out of self-esteem, and so it can show up a lot of different ways. But I'd say in general, that's what we see more than kind of your classic depression. You know, where somebody's just like, oh, you know, have that negative cognitive schema going on. You know, it's usually greatly informed by a lot of catastrophizing and nightmarish thinking.
So. And substance abuse. I mean, you know, a lot of students who are drinking are likely doing so because of anxiety and stress because they have to, you know, unwind, mm-hmm. and they have to, you know, they're coping with a lot of that stress through those, you know, I had the other thought about when we were talking about, you know, what is the solution?
Yeah.
The other part of the solution is that it is going to fall into the lap of the parents, I think. I've told this story before, but I teach a couple graduate courses. And I actually had the mother of one of my graduate students call me about a grade that her daughter got in my class. And
wow.
And I'm thinking, she, you know, she's in her mid to late 20s, mm-hmm. in a graduate program, and this mother is calling me. What? I don't understand when the accountability, when the responsibility is going to finally fall on the person who is ultimately responsible for what she's doing.
Yeah, I think if the students are anxious, and that was my, you know, if we look for a solution, if we're dealing with anxious students or students who tend toward anxiety, then we may have to hold their hand through this process, mm-hmm. and have each program, I'm thinking that what you would say to education majors would be very different from what you would say to medical students,
right.
would be very different from what you say to engineers.
Yeah.
And I think each program should have some way of preparing them for the next step. We know we know that they're not being prepared for the next step. They're disappointed when they get there. Mm-hmm. They don't know what to do when they arrive. And I think it's, I think each program has to decide how they're going to prepare students for that next step.
So can I tell you what that actually looks like in practicality? Because I think, Richard, you hit it right on what's happening, is now counseling centers are no longer hiring just generalists. They're hiring people that are embedded within certain schools.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And so in the last year, we've hired people who are in our dental school, in our nursing school. We were hiring somebody this year who's going to be in our engineering school. Mm-hmm. I was hired specifically as a men's mental health specialist. We have Mandarin specialists, like people who speak Mandarin, Chinese international school specialists. We have Latino specialists. So there becomes this specialization to match what you just said, Richard, both by academic degree as well as identity.
Right.
So,
wow. That's great.
Yeah, because Bernie and I have worked in medical school, so we would be of value there, but I wouldn't know what to say to a computer engineer,
right.
A software engineer. I would have no idea what to say to him.
Right.
You know, I could speak generally, but I couldn't give him any specific advice. So I do think it should be program specific.
Yeah.
And then I want to go back to your story just for a second, Bernie, that you just told about that mother calling. Yeah. You know what? I mean, like, I have two thoughts about that. One, that's not that atypical,
right,
to be honest. Like, in my world, you know, it's not like we get parents calling, and it's for various things. I mean, that's pretty superficial, like, you know, help, they're trying to change the grade or whatever. Right. But we also get parents who are like freaking out because their kid's psychotic and they don't understand it and they want us to like help explain. But I think the dark side of that is with millennials, when people view millennials, there ends up being this confirmation bias around like narcissism.
Yes.
And confirmation bias around like being spoiled and having everything handed to them. Because I also know I have a ton of students who have alcoholic parents.
Yeah.
Who do not care at all about their academic success. And they have been working, and they're working three jobs while they're here. And nobody's flashing a spotlight as here's the counter example to what we think a narcissist is, or a narcissistic millennial is.
Right.
And so on one hand, I respect that story because it totally reflects my reality. And then I'm like, it also hurts my heart a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
No, true. It's true. Yeah. Yeah. There are absolutely two ends to that. And I'm sure, at a huge university like where you're working, you're going to see that broad spectrum. So yeah, absolutely. I'm still really impressed with the system that you guys have there, because it sounds like one of the other things that you guys are doing there that some of the other colleges and universities could pick up on is recognizing that you can't reach every student individually. You have these systems in place where, you know, it's a little bit less threatening. It's a little bit less sort of stereotypical or much of a stigma, where you can come and you can, you know, listen to an hour long lecture by a specialist talking about, you know, mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, that, I mean, come out of necessity. You know, and people have gotten really creative, and we have a really great relationship with other schools within the Big Ten. Which is actually like the Big 14, but for some reason we keep calling it the Big 10 for some reason. And so we're constantly stealing ideas and ideas from one another. Mm-hmm. So even though, like, for example, we're rivals with Michigan, we steal ideas from them. They steal ideas from us all the time because we all have the same problem. And so we have a conference every year. It's called the Big 10 Counseling Center Conference, where we all get together and share ideas. And a lot of it is just like having roundtable discussions around, like, you guys are doing this, we're doing that. And it's funny to see, like, somebody will start something and then it'll spread. And you'll see all the Big 10 counseling centers are starting to do it. So a lot of it is collaboration. We're learning from each other on how, what's working and what's not working. So, you know, if you try something and you see, or excuse me, if you want to try something, you can look at 13 other models and see if they've tried it. And if they have and it's been successful, let's go for it. And if they've tried it and it's failed, how can we either not do it or like do it in a way that's going to work, you know, or not make the same mistakes. But yeah, we do a lot of different things, and we're always trying out new things. And one of the things I really respect about my agency is they allot us a lot of creativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, like, I do like a whole men's mental health kind of month where we do all this outreach to men, because men are 4 times more likely to commit suicide than women. And 90% of college suicides are men.
Wow.
And so, you know, so to me, it's like a huge thing that we got to do something to, you know, help guys out or to reach out to guys. Because of course, like you guys know, they're less likely to come into counseling. Mm-hmm. And even if they get to counseling, less likely to stay in counseling.
Right.
And so, yeah, we're trying things.
Yeah, that's great.
Kip, when you talk about the Big 14, are you all seeing similar problems at similar rates? Like most of you are still are dealing with anxiety. Do you find that you're all dealing with the same problems?
Yeah, pretty much. I would say, you know, it's maybe a little different, maybe a little bit for like Maryland or Rutgers. They might be dealing with a little bit more unique just because they're on the East Coast. And I think where their students are coming from, there's different things versus, I think, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, you know, Purdue, all Wisconsin. We're seeing similar students from similar cultural backgrounds a lot of the time. So, but overall, I would say we are seeing very similar trends. And a lot of things I've talked about today come from hearing from other clinical directors or hearing from other directors of other counseling centers talk. And so, yeah, definitely, we're all seeing pretty much similar things. And, I mean, I'll just say from my own clinical experience of working in the University of California system, which has 10 campuses, you know, they're seeing the same things we're seeing here.
They are.
So, you know, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just the rise of anxiety, the need for a college degree, the social comparison, social media, you know, attention span affecting academic performance, you know.
Yeah. So. Wow, yeah.
Well, go ahead. No, I was thinking about the more serious psychopathology that you're dealing with now, because with ADA and all the federal laws that are in place, you can't deny admission to those students. Are you obligated? Do you feel pressure to keep them in school? I mean,
I think it's a tricky thing, and often it's a case-by-case basis, to be honest. I mean, we have no control whether or not they're in school. We have control of whether or not we see them here in the counseling center, or right. if we try to get them connected to outside resources. So almost every counseling center now has hired a case manager or two. Wow. And so our case manager, who's absolutely wonderful, her name's Jennifer, she actually will go to the hospital and visit with students when they've been hospitalized. Mm-hmm. And like kind of make sure, and then she meets with all the students who get hospitalized when they come out, so they have a nice contingency plan going forward from the hospital, rather than just like, okay, you're not suicidal anymore, see you later.
Right.
So we actually, then it's a matter of like, who has space, what time of the year is it, you know, because we're going to pick up more people in August than we are in December.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because we just can't. In December, we're so overpacked, and we have, you know, a wait list, and we're doing our best we can, and everybody's working hard, and just our therapists are feeling burned out.
Sure.
You know, so it's, you know, but I think what happens a lot of times, there's a lot of stigma around those students. So, for example, let's say a student has a paranoid episode in the dorms. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So outside of just how that's affecting that student directly, there's also there's kind of a ripple effect that affects the other students in the dorm. It affects that student socially.
Right.
Because then they can get stigmatized just as being like odd or strange or something like that. So we actually have to be thinking about it in multiple ways at a time, multiple layers of it at all the time. And then, you know, substance abuse always makes those cases dramatically more complicated.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, and like, you know, something we talk about a lot, so you guys mentioned drinking before. It's amazing, even across my 6 years of doing this work, how much less drinking is going on in college campuses and how much more drugs and pills
right.
and cocaine and things like it's almost moving away from like cheap beer,
right.
you know, like
right.
and moving toward like, you know, really synthesized marijuana that students are smoking through a crazy apparatus, or, you know, it's
right.
totally different. And so students don't fully understand that if they have marijuana, that's 25 more potent than 25 times more potent than what the Beatles smoked.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That, you know, that can have a major impact on them and their mental health.
Right.
Plus there's so much media around like, oh no, marijuana is good for depression. It's good for anxiety. It's like perfectly fine for you. It hasn't. And it's what I have to have a conversation with students over and over again is, it's fine for some people and not fine for other people. In the same way, I always give the example, like when you go to a party and people get drunk, there's the guy who gets angry. There's the person who can't get up and they lay down on the floor. There's the person who like keeps whispering in your ear that they love you. You know, like there's all the, you know, everybody does something differently. And so the same thing that goes with, you know, marijuana, especially if you have that genetic predisposition toward bipolar, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, you know, severe depression, anything like that, it's going to have a very big impact on you compared to somebody else. So,
right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep. Now we've already kept you for like an hour almost.
Has it been?
We're getting close to an hour. Yeah. But, what do you have any advice from your experience and everything? Do you have any advice for those high school seniors who just graduated or are about to graduate, you know, for them and or their parents as they're kind of entering into college, what kind of advice might you pass on to them? Or maybe should we pass on to
What should we pass on to them and say, hey, look, because all the kids are getting ready to go to college now. They just graduated from high school. They're on their way. Some are leaving. We had one of my daughter's friends came over last night. She's leaving at the end of June. She's going to do summer school before she enrolls. And so what should we advise parents to tell their children to prepare?
Okay. So I think the place where I would start is being very conscientious and thoughtful about those classes that they're taking during that first semester. Okay. So a lot of students are doing that thing we talked about earlier where they're diving in like to the deep end. So they'll start off the semester like, I want to be an engineer. So you know what? I'm going to take intro to engineering, calculus, physics, and chemistry, and then I'll take psychology.
Right. Yeah. That'll be the easy class.
Right. And that'll be the easy class, right? And so what happens is they get into those classes and they haven't had to study like this before, or in high school, they, you know, their classes were easy for them and they're not used to, I have to spend, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours on a chemistry assignment. Or it takes me an entire day to solve one physics problem, right?
Right.
So what I
right.
tell students is don't take these super hard science, really difficult classes on day one. Like, walk into the shallow end of college.
Right.
Like, it's okay. Like, most students are not going to get out in 4 years. That's okay. Take that fifth year. Like, take 4 classes rather than 5. Because in addition to getting used to the new academic load, you're having to make friends. You're having to like literally figure out where you are geographically. You're having to figure out how to eat and do your laundry and all of that extra stuff. So it's like we've already got a lot of transition stuff happening. Why do we want to add an additional like super hard academic load on top of that?
Right.
So what I would say to parents is, you know, when your students are going there, don't pressure them to do the exact same thing that they did in high school. Have them slowly get into the water of college. And tell them that it's a major focus to connect with a healthy, good social group.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is something I see a lot with kids is, you know, there'll be a kid who smoked a lot of weed back in high school, right? And then, or maybe like a moderate amount of weed. They like smoked once on the weekend or something. And then they get here, they meet other kids who smoke weed, and then they start smoking together. And then they decide to live together during sophomore year.
Yeah.
Right. So when they get together, now they have 4 or 5 guys living in a house who smoke every single night. And it becomes normal for them.
Right.
Right. And although they're good friends and they would probably take a bullet for one another, it ultimately affects them negatively because of the social group that they got connected with.
Absolutely.
So it's really important to convey to students like, hey, you want to be around like other people who have similar goals and ideas and dreams that you do, because you can help one another and connect with one another and do homework with one another.
Right.
The other thing I would say is it's really important for them to build a relationship with their professors.
Yes.
Even if it's a really, really big school and there's 500 people in the class, like usually there's a TA or something like that, like that you can connect with, because I think a lot of these students, they get into these more difficult classes and then they go off on their own and try to do this stuff. And then they just end up going like, oh, I'm not smart enough to do this. So I guess I won't be an engineer. When in actuality, all they need to do is go talk to that TA, and that TA is going to help them out a lot.
Absolutely.
So those are the things. The other thing I would say is, you know, just trying to don't think of your GPA as being maybe as powerful as like it actually is. Yeah. Like it's really not that powerful in real life. And the reason a lot of students end up thinking that way is because, for example, when we have like an engineering career fair, you know, Google will be here, Amazon will be here, Apple will be here, and they're only taking they're only taking resumes from people that have 3.5 or better GPAs. Mm-hmm. Well, we happen to know that our engineering students have a 2.9 average GPA.
Right.
Right. So what's happening is the students are thinking, oh, they're only going to take 3.5 GPA. I'm obviously not smart enough. That doesn't matter. But they don't realize the only reason that Apple has that guideline is so they don't walk out of the career fair with 5,000 resumes.
Right, right.
And so they think that that translates to real life. And what I tell a lot of students is I talk about it in the Beating Anxiety workshop that I do each week, is your GPA doesn't really matter all that much.
Right.
It only correlates with job success if it's extremely high or extremely low. And anywhere else, you're going to use it to get your first job, and then you'll probably take it off your resume.
Right.
And it's really hard for them to believe it, because what do we know from cognitive dissonance, right? They've become so invested in this belief, and they can't, like, to tell them that it was all useless. it wasn't. Like, it ultimately doesn't mean that much. It has to, you're right, exactly. It has to be meaningful. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's not, ultimately, is really hard for them. And yeah. So I would say, instilling that sense of confidence that isn't tied directly to academic achievement is really important.
Yeah, I would think that, and as you were telling the story about, Apple and Google and all those guys there, and saying only 3.5s, I would think that maybe that's a strategy by them also to say, who's going to have the confidence and security to come and talk to us, even if they don't have a 3.5, because that's going to be some characteristics and attributes that we are interested also.
It's another skill set.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, yeah, for sure. And So, building that sense of confidence, what's another thing I'll just say, and I can't even believe how much of this work I have to do. And I'm not saying I'm doing like the parents' work or anything. Tell your kids you're proud of them. Tell your kids that you love them unconditionally, right? And that even if college doesn't work out, it's not going to be the end of the world.
Yeah.
And so I end up telling, like in my men's group that I run, I'd say my primary intervention is telling these guys that I'm proud of them. Like when they come in and they're like, hey, I got a good grade in this class, and I'm like, I'm really proud of you. It's like you can see the tears well up in these guys' eyes.
Yeah.
Just because they've been so deprived of those just simple, I love you, unconditional messages.
Yeah.
Just continuously telling your kid throughout college that no matter what, that safety net's going to be there for them. And they're not going to get less love or be ostracized from the family if they're not successful.
I never thought of that one.
Yeah. But, wow. That's
good
really
advice.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't think of that sort of stuff. You know, you just assume that all parents are giving their kids those messages, but they don't. You're right.
And I think it takes us back to one of the very first things that you said, that, what is it, 30, mid-30s percent of people have a bachelor's degree. And so, we've used statistics that are, of course, very similar to that, mm-hmm. Only about 30% of high school graduates go to college, and of those that go to college, only about 30% of them, or I'm sorry, about 60% of them graduate. Mm-hmm. So it's the population of people who really actually complete college is smaller than we tend to think, because everybody just assumes, well, after you graduate high school, you're just supposed to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Those people don't tend to finish, and so loving them no matter what, whether they finish or not, or as long as they're working, and that, they're your kid no matter what. So you love them. So
right. And paradoxically, telling them those things will probably result in them being successful and finishing.
Exactly.
The kids who are freaking out and having the panic attack during the test don't know that.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. They feel as though that affection and that love from their parent is dependent upon how well they're doing.
Right.
And yeah, you have to let them know that it's not. So that's great.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right.
Okay. Well, that was fun.
Yeah. We have like all of your contact information. Now the Podomatic, and that's, I love that name. It's a great podcast. I was mentioning to you before we started that I loved the podcast about South Park.
Yeah.
So we're going to put the link to your podcast up on the show notes and everything, so people can follow you.
Actually, it was the South Park podcast where I realized you were a millennial.
Yeah,
I said nobody knows this much and not being.
The podcast is called The Midwestern Social Scientist. It's me and a sociologist. He's a sociology PhD student. He's finishing up here in the next couple of years, named Keith McIntosh. And we get together and we talk about anything from cultural stuff to political stuff to tragedies that have happened, kind of whatever comes up for us that we think is interesting. This week's episode, actually, that went out just yesterday, is actually on Snapchat.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Fantastic.
And so that episode came out yesterday, and like kind of the implications. So it actually ties to you all's podcast very well about technology, which is why I was so interested in it, about how it's like this rapid fire peekaboo stimulus response game that people are playing. Right? And it's just like, it's like Instagram is too slow now. It has to be even faster than that. Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, I'll listen to that with my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Our streaming service that we utilize is Podomatic, but it's also available on iTunes. So definitely check us out, Midwestern Social Scientist. And I would love to have one of you fine doctors, gentlemen, on the podcast at some point.
Absolutely.
So, you name the date.
We'd love to. Yeah, it's MidwesternSocialScientist.podomatic.com is the website. Right. And like I said, I'll put the link to the iTunes and into the Podomatic site up on the show notes and everything. And your Twitter is at DocKipp, DocKipp. We'll pass that on as well.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, it's been wonderful in talking to you guys, and keep up the awesome work. I love your show. I love your intro, your little music that you guys have. It's so great. So,
thank you, because we
take a little heat for that.
It's just fun to me. I like it.
Oh, don't let them hate. Don't let the haters get to you. You gotta hang out. I like it. So
fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being on with us today. And you, of course, anytime, like we said at the beginning, you have so much work that you've been doing and so many interests. Anytime you want to come back on and talk about anything else, just let us know. We're happy to have you.
Definitely. Cool. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Great. Well, have a great day. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Kip. Bye.